Inside the Game with Pat Williams is a pre-recorded show.
It's time for Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams, and we get to talk sports. Oh, I love doing this, and we have so many interesting guests that join us. So thanks for joining yourself right here on AM 950, FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. Jeffrey Sennis gets us on the air. He's our engineer. Andrew Hurd Liska produces the show every weekend for us. And I want to introduce to you my friend Gordy Jones. He's up in the Philadelphia area. And as an old Philly guy, every now and then I get, I get homesick for Philadelphia sports. And you need a guy like Gordy Jones to update us. So, Gordy, welcome to Orlando. How are you doing?
Outstanding, Pat. Always good to talk with you. I have fond memories of working with you on our Sixers books a few years back. So it's good to reconnect.
Well, Gordy, first of all, spring training is raging. It's beginning here in central, all over the state of Florida and Arizona. Mm-hmm. And in nearby Clearwater, Florida, the Phillies are going to spring training, and the expectations for this new season are what?
I would say really, really high, Pat. They re-signed Aaron Nola. They're one of their key starting pitchers in the offseason, and so they're loaded up and ready to rock again. I mean, they have a very formidable lineup once again, and you know, they were one win away from getting to the World Series, you know, returning to the World Series last year, and they lost their last two games of the NLCS at home, oddly enough. So I would obviously, they want to get beyond that level, and they're a team that's constructed to win now. We know that, and I'm sure that's their aim. I mean, they have a very rabid fan base behind them. I mean, nothing quite like the Phillies in September and October. Their stadium really rocks, and they want to take that next step and, you know, win the World Series, which has proven a little elusive these last couple of years, but they're certainly in the mix. They're on the short list of teams that can win it this year, that's for sure.
Gordy, did you think there would be more free agent efforts by the Phillies?
I didn't think so, because they had kind of taken their big swings the last couple off seasons, you know, bringing in Trey Turner, JT Realmuto, bringing in Bryce Harper a few years before that. So they had their foundation in place. So I think it made sense, you know, work more to retain a guy like Nola and make sure that they had him locked down. And so I think they, you know, maybe there's another move to be made here. If, you know, our friend Jim Salisbury, who has covered the Phillies with distinction for a long time for a couple different outlets, said that maybe they'll be in play for some of the remaining free agents if the price comes down a little bit as we get closer to the start of the season. But I don't think they're going to take the, you know, obviously they haven't yet taken the big swings this offseason, and I don't think they were there really to be made, because I think their team is in place. It really is.
Gordy, I want you to talk about the Eagles and this season that was so to such a high level, and it just seemed to all just fall apart.
That's a real mystery, isn't it? They were 10-1 at one point, and then they just kind of fizzled out toward the end and lost to Tampa in the first round of the playoffs. It was really a surprise. It's almost like they were on the wrong end of a one-sided loss to Tampa Bay, or excuse me, to San Francisco, and that kind of, you know, sent them in the wrong direction. And they never really did recover from that. So clearly, there's some internal things that need to be addressed to get them back on the right track. They've retained their head coach Nick Sirianni, even though there were some scuttlebutt that maybe that wouldn't be the case. So and they're replacing their coordinators and seeing if they can get the mojo back that was, you know, so significant for so long. They had a couple guys that are sort of on the downside, so that certainly plays into it. And this week we've heard talk that Hassan Reddick is free to explore a trade to go elsewhere. He's one of their key pass rushers. So they're kind of in a state, maybe flux is too strong a word, Pat, but they're sort of in an uncertain stage of their growth curve. You know, they were there in the Super Bowl last year, and right there, as far as beating Kansas City benefited from a perhaps questionable penalty at the end to win that game, a very exciting game. But I don't know what to make of them at this point. It's really kind of an odd situation because they're close, but are they close enough? That's a real question to me.
Gordy Jones is our guest, a longtime reporter of sports activities in the greater Philadelphia area. Is Philadelphia happy for Andy Reid's success?
That's a good question. I mean, he was in Philadelphia for so long, and he was very successful, but couldn't quite get over the hump. I would think there's enough of a remove now that, you know, that there's an understanding that things kind of ran their course in Philadelphia, and he needed to move on to a new, you know, to greener pastures, or however you want to phrase that. So I don't know if they're happy for him. I wouldn't think there's like a widespread animosity to him at this point. I mean, there was frustration with him when he was in Philadelphia, but I don't know if there's, I would like to think it's somewhere in the middle that, you know, they're happy with their coach and their team for the most part, you know, this season notwithstanding. And, you know, Andy's free to do his thing. I mean, he's won three now in Kansas City. Yeah, but he certainly needed a fresh start because things had kind of petered out at the end of his tenure in Philadelphia. So it was time to start over. So I don't know. That's a difficult question for me to answer as far as how everybody feels. Well, I don't think there's any animosity toward him. I mean, you know, good for him that he's won. It's certainly he's now in the conversation among the, you know, the 10 or 15 greatest coaches of all time. He's won three of them. And as you know, it's always a matter of aligning yourself with the right quarterback, and certainly he has that.
Gordy, the injury to Embiid with the 76ers.
Oh, boy.
Has been obviously devastating. Where are the Sixers headed?
Boy, that's the $64,000 question, isn't it? I mean, they're saying that he's not even going to be evaluated until mid-March. So then you're still 3 weeks, a month away from the playoffs. So that's just evaluated. That doesn't mean he's back and on the court and getting ready to ramp up again. So, boy, I don't know what to make of them now. They made a few trades on the margins at the deadline, the most significant of which brought Buddy Hield to them from Indiana, and he's paid immediate dividends. But boy, without Embiid, they're not going far, Pat. And even with him, you know, you wonder if they were going to get. They haven't been beyond the second round since 2001, which is unfathomable to me. And they haven't won a title since 1983 when you were there, Pat. So maybe need to go back and rally the troops, Pat. I don't know.
How is Nick Nurse being received?
I think he's done well, but you know, if Embiid, even by his standard, was having a great season this year, and he was again leading the league in scoring for the third straight year. You know, his points per minute played were ridiculously good, but without him, boy, and at the other end, he's such a factor on the defensive end as just being a rim protector and covering up others' mistakes. It's such a huge loss in every way. I mean, they've had Tyrese Maxey has emerged as a great number two player, and obviously they have another guy in Buddy Hield who looks like he's going to really help, and they've had guys Nick Batum, you know, Kelly Oubre Jr., Tobias Harris, guys like that are helpful players. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know what to make of their trade deadline, if that signals that they know more about Embiid's condition than everybody else. It was a meniscus injury that he had surgery on in his right knee. So I don't know if that signals that they know more about it than anybody else, and they're just pulling the plug on this season and just ready to clear salary cap space to make a run next year, or if they feel like, you know, they will have Embiid for the playoffs and now we have the right pieces around him. I don't know exactly how to read where they are, but certainly they're in a very tenuous place.
Gordy Jones, who covers sports in the greater Philadelphia area, is our guest. How will Doc Rivers be remembered in Philly?
There seems to be some lingering ill will toward Doc, and now he's reemerged as the coach with the Bucks, and yeah, burned the bridges is the wrong phrase, but it just seemed like he is not remembered fondly for his short-lived tenure with the Sixers and just how things kind of petered out there. So it's a really, you know, not getting over the top, or it really tends to linger. And I don't know how much was his fault and how much was just the roster wasn't right or They just weren't ready to win, or Embiid's health is always sort of a question mark, especially late in the season. So, yeah, it doesn't feel like he's going to be remembered fondly there, Pat. It seems like that's something the fan base has really kind of held against him for a while.
Josh Harris Group buys the Washington Commanders.
Right.
How did that play in Philly?
Well, there's a guy on WIP, Glenn Macna, who worked for the Inquirer when you were in Philly, and he really his phrase for Josh is always that he calls him a carpetbagger, because not only does he own the Sixers and the Commanders, but he also owns the New Jersey Devils. So that's three very different markets and three very different sports, and I don't know how you can devote your time and energy to all three, but I guess he's going to try. I'm sure he believes he has the right people in place to do the day-to-day stuff at all three operations, and that he can, you know, take the 10,000 foot view. So that's at least Glenn's view. It's certainly interesting to me that someone would A, want to do that, and B, believe they can do that. I mean, how does that look to you, Pat? Because you've obviously been on that side, but how do you feel about something like
well,
that?
Well, let me just say this. When you're operating a team, you live and die with mm-hmm. every dribble or every pitch, mm-hmm. every pass. I mean, you literally just suffer with it.
Mm-hmm.
So you better, if you're owning three teams, that's a lot of potential suffering. So,
yeah.
So you better be in a helicopter up above it all. If you're an investor in sports teams and not live and die with every pitch. I mean, it'll drive you nuts.
How could it not? How could it not? You know, there's a sizable, you know, beyond the financial end of it, there's a sizable emotional investment. It kind of has to be that way, right?
No question. Gordy Jones is our guest. We're talking Philly sports. I'm Pat Williams. The show that you're listening to is Inside the Game. The station, AM 950, FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. We have another segment with Gordy. Stay with us. Gordy Jones has been covering sports in Philadelphia for many, many, many years. He is with us, and we're getting caught up on the Philadelphia sports scene. I must admit, I got a little lonely this week, and wanted to get caught up on my old hometown, and that's what we're doing. Gordy, what is the what's the hockey / flyer situation these days in Philly?
I'm not a big hockey guy, as you know, Pat, but I know that they're doing better than they normally do. So I'm a bad guy to ask about that, I'm sorry to say. But I know that the things are looking a little better than they have in recent seasons, and that's really the extent of my hockey knowledge, I'm sorry to say.
Well, I'm not far apart on that. What does WIP radio mean to the sports scene in Philly?
Well, that's an interesting thing in this day and age when everybody's attention is taken in so many different ways by online outlets and things like that. I think it's still strong. I don't know ratings-wise or anything like that. I don't know how that plays, but it's still a voice. But as you well know, there's a lot of clamor from a lot of angles in a lot of different ways these days. So I guess it's still a factor. I know it's still popular to some degree, but it'd be hard for me to imagine it's as popular as it was, 15 years ago. It's a different, it's a different climate, a different landscape than it used to be media-wise.
What is the station like without Angelo Cataldo?
I can't say that I don't think I ever listened to the morning show. It's nothing against those guys. I mean, whatever. I never did because of just my hours and just my habits. So I can't say anything about that. Hey, Pat, I did want to ask you about this. I mean, we had Earl Cureton on a podcast that I have. It's called After the Buzzer. We had him on in January. He had a book out, and I was really saddened when Earl passed recently. What are your memories of Earl?
Oh, Gordy, let me just tell you, I had the same experience. I had him on this show maybe a month ago.
Right,
Talking about this book of his that's coming out. And he was wonderful.
Yep.
Happy, joyous. I mean, it was a wonderful visit. Mm-hmm. And then I picked the paper up, 2 weeks ago, and he died of a heart attack in the shower on a Sunday morning. Mm-hmm. And I still can't believe it. But Gordy, here's one for you.
Mm-hmm.
Every Philadelphia center,
right,
Sixers center, since the 60s, is gone early in life, with the exception of Harvey Catchings.
Yeah, and he had a heart transplant.
And he's had health issues. But
but
every center, go back to Wilt. Mm-hmm. Or go back to Neil Johnston. He way back in the '50s, he died young.
Right.
Then Wilt. Yeah. Then Caldwell Jones. Then Daryl Dawkins. Then Moses Malone. And then Earl Cureton, who's in his sixties.
Yeah. Mark McNamara also.
He died young. Daryl Imhoff died fairly young. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah, we've had this conversation before, and it's one of those things that it's hard to put, hard to pin it down. I mean, Kareem has had quadruple bypass. A smaller guy, Nate Archibald, he had a heart transplant a few years back. I talked to Joe Rogowski. He's, I think he used to be down with you guys, and he's now works for the league. In a health care capacity. And he has these health screenings for former players at arenas throughout the country periodically, and hoping to forestall some of these issues. But he's at a loss, and he told me it's one of those things that, at least part of it is the fact that, you don't play anymore, and you're not as active as you used to be, and in part because a lot of these guys take on orthopedic issues from having played so long, and you're not as active, and that does take its toll on your heart. But also just bigger guys, for whatever reason. So it really is sad, because all of these guys either died in their 60s or in Harvey's case, had a transplant. And Harvey was in his late 60s when he had his transplant. That happened in 2019. So it's really a sad tale, and really kind of especially unfortunate for the Sixers. Just all those guys, as you mentioned, from the 60s on, I particularly from that era when you were there, for 74 to like 86, like all those guys have had these heart issues. It's really a sad tale.
And Gordy, go further. Look around the league, the NBA, mm-hmm. with centers who died fairly young. Nate Thurmond.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Boerwinkel,
mm-hmm.
Walt Bellamy,
mm-hmm.
Wesley Unseld,
right,
and then you've got Bob Cousy at 94, is still sharp as a tack.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is.
He
had a book out a couple years ago. I'm sure you saw it. It was really well done. It talked a lot about his relationship with Bill Russell. It was a really great book. I enjoyed that very much.
Russell and Kareem are the only two centers that I know of that have lived lengthy lives. Bill lived well into his 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Kareem is, he's late 70s.
Yeah, and he had bypass surgery, quadruple bypass. So I forget how long ago it was. I'm going to guess it was like 2015, somewhere in there. So
plus a cancer battle.
I
know that's not your main beat. What's the health of the Philadelphia Big Five and the Palestra and all the?
Yeah, what's going on? They didn't have a team in the tournament last year. And a friend of mine, Aaron Bracey, had just started a website where he covers the Big Five. And apparently it's questionable as to whether they will have one in this year. They're kind of coming down the home stretch here and seeing if somebody can catch lightning in a bottle and get there, because it's not been as strong as it once was.
Can you believe, Gordy, all of those Villanova players under Jay mm-hmm. Wright, all in the NBA right now, many of them playing with the Knicks, But but beyond that, you know, Lowry's just returned to Philly, and Bay is down there in Atlanta. It's just unbelievable that run that Jay Wright had at Villanova. Do you agree?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Mikal Bridges, a guy who got better every year at Villanova and was on two national championship teams, and now he's a very, very good player for the Nets. And Jalen Brunson, a second-round pick, Pat. Second-round pick, and he might be the best of the lot. And for the Knicks, just a real star player who anybody could have had when he came out in the draft. It's kind of hard to believe. And, you know, of course, you know the story with Mikal Bridges. The Sixers actually drafted him, and his mom actually worked in the Sixers organization, and then they turned around on draft night and traded him to the Suns, which, you know, didn't work out well for the Sixers at all. And, you know, can you imagine them if they would have kept him? Because he's really turned into a really good player.
What were the Sixers thinking that night? What in the world was going on?
I don't know. I guess it was like one of those paralysis by analysis things. Well, if we trade him, we can get an extra number one and a player. But boy, there's a guy that you really whiffed on there, because he's an excellent player at both ends. You know, just one of those guys who you see get better every year that he's played. At Villanova, when he started out, he was just a kind of a defensive guy. And then he kept on developing, and, you know, and then he comes in the NBA, and now he's a very respectable scorer. So, they kind of whiffed on that one. I mean, you know, you know this better than anybody. Nobody shoots 100% on trades, but, boy, that one, I think they'd like to have that one back.
Listen, Gordy, before we part, it's been 41 years since the Sixers title in 83. You have studied that team. You have written about it. You've analyzed it. A quick thought on that team.
Oh, boy. Such a driven group. You know this as well as anyone. I mean, they had been disappointed so many times before. They were in the finals in 77, 80, 82. They had in 81, they nearly blew a 3-1 lead in the Eastern Finals for the second straight year and won Game 7 up in Boston, only to fall in the finals to the Lakers again. Boy, such a driven group. You know, and you're right. It's like I have been around those guys. I was there when Maurice Cheeks went into the Hall of Fame, which really made me happy. I was there when Bobby Jones went into the Hall of Fame. You know, both guys just, you know, to me, those are the kind of guys that should be in the Hall of Fame as much as anybody else, because maybe they weren't huge stat guys, but they were such winning players, and they had those guys over and over and over again. And Moses was such a force, and Julius was such an elegant player and such a classy guy off the court, always had time for everyone. It was one of those seasons where everything just coalesced, and they kind of had to get it done because they finally got the one guy they really needed in Moses. And, boy, what a special season. It's just so rare for everything to just fall into place as it did that year. It was just such a special thing. And I always go back to the one thing when we were working on the Sixers book, you talked about how was it Clayton Sheldon, the one guy in your building?
Yeah, yes.
Who saw the guys the day they had the parade, and when Moses went by, those construction workers raised their lunch pails and salute to Moses. That to me is just one of the most perfect salutes ever, don't you think, Pat?
Yeah, that Clayton spotted that. It's a memorable story. A construction crew, lunchtime on their break. Right. All these floats are coming by, a couple of million people on the streets. And as Moses' float goes by, these 12 construction guys stand up and hold up their lunch pails in tribute to Moses, who was a lunch pail ball player. You know,
he was.
he just went in and battled on the boards, and you know, fought for every rebound and led the league in perspiration.
You know? He did that. Boy, you know what's funny? Sometimes on NBA TV, they'll show games from that era. And it's so interesting to watch those games compared to the way the game is now. I'm not saying, you know, this is not one of those get off my lawn kind of things, but it's just in that era with, you know, the 3-point line was there, but it was barely used. You know, you have like 8 to 10 guys within 10 feet of the rim on any given possession. And now the game is like played, you know, it's so spread out. And it's different. And I'm not saying I like one or the other better, but it's certainly very, very different than it used to be. It's really interesting to me to watch those old clips as compared to now.
Gordy Jones has been our guest. Thanks for plugging in on this session with Gordy. We've got more. Stay with us. I'm Pat Williams, your host. It's Inside the Game. And this is AM 950, FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. We'll be right back. Gordy Jones, our guest, talking sports in Philadelphia, an old friend. Well, we go from Philadelphia, we go to Detroit. Mike Rosenbaum is with us, Detroit area sports writer and editor. But this fascinating book is out, University of Michigan Basketball, 1960 to 1989, from Cassie Russell to the NCAA title. Mike, welcome to Orlando. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing? Thanks for having me on.
How did this book come about? What prompted it?
Well, I was interested in getting into book writing. I was doing newspaper writing, and University of Michigan sports was a big interest to me. And, of course, as you'd expect, there are a ton of books about University of Michigan football. But very few about basketball, so I thought I'd take the road less traveled. I was interested to find out there was only one book on the history of Michigan basketball, and that was written in the 70s. Mm. So we were ripe for something to fill in that time. And I decided to start with 1960 because what I wanted to do is not just a who, what, when, where book with the stats and who won and scores, but really kind of go behind the scenes and talk about talk to players and coaches about how these teams were built and what the team dynamics were, what made them work, what made some teams not work. And so that's how it started really a while ago, back in 2010, starting to do interviews.
Mike, here's how it opens. I want you to talk about building the house, 1960 to 1968. What's going on?
Well, in 1960, Michigan hired Dave Strack to be their new head coach. They were coming off a really bad season. Dave Strack had been a player at Michigan and a longtime assistant, and he'd only had 1 year as head coach out on the West Coast, and he came back to be Michigan's head coach. And he started, to recruit much better. He found a guy named Bill Bunton, and he found, of course, Cassie Russell, who was these two guys really were the foundations of Michigan basketball. And Cassie, you know, is kind of the icon of Michigan basketball. But Bill Bunton, who came in a year earlier, is really just as big of a story because it really shows the difference between what recruiting was like then and now, because Bill Bunton missed his entire senior high school season after breaking his leg playing football, and really no one knew about him. He was this great player, and if it were today, you know, he would have gone to camps, he would be on the internet, he would be well known, but because he didn't play as a senior, he wasn't known. And a Michigan assistant coach found out about him and saw him play in a summer league, and Michigan got him in, and he became the foundation 1 year before Cassie Russell came in, and the team really took off, winning three straight Big Ten championships and reaching the NCAA final in 1965.
Tell me more about Cassie Russell.
Well, Russell, he grew up actually as a baseball player. His father was a baseball player, and he never played organized basketball until high school. He's as a freshman, he's walking through the halls. He's I think about 6'2" back then as a high school freshman, and the basketball coach sees him and says, "Hey, come on after school and shoot some hoops and let's see what you've got. And he did, and he convinced Kazzy to join the basketball team, and that was the beginning of his story. So he really, he wasn't on the radar really for recruiting until he was maybe a junior in high school. And then he really took off and came and was interested in Michigan. He's one of those guys who is interested in coming into a team that's building something. Because at that point, Michigan, the first 2 years under Dave Strack, were still not very good, a little bit better than they had been previously, but still losing records. But Kazzy, you know, he must have been a smart guy even back then, because he saw the team was developing. He saw they had a foundation in the big center, Bill Bunton, the guy I mentioned earlier, and he liked what Michigan was developing. And he decided to join a program on the way up, kind of get in on the ground floor, is what he told me later, that he was really interested in pursuing. And he also thought it was divinely inspired. He said he thought God sent him to Michigan for a purpose. And so he led Michigan up to the top.
Mike Rosenbaum is our guest. The book, University of Michigan Basketball. Mike, let me move to the second era. On the Run, 1968, 1973. Tell us about this period.
That's the first half of the Johnny Orr era. Johnny Orr was a lead assistant for Dave Strack. He had been an assistant and a head coach in Massachusetts, and he left coaching for a year to sell insurance, but he kind of got the bug to get back into it. And Dave Strack was looking for a new assistant, and he knew Johnny Orr from the time when Orr was at Wisconsin as an assistant. So he calls Johnny Orr and he says, I'm looking for an assistant. If you know of anybody, let me know. And Orr calls him back a few weeks later. Hey, I got an assistant for you. It's me. He kind of got himself the job, and then Strack kind of got an elevation up to business manager at Michigan. He didn't really leave or didn't get fired. He kind of, the new athletic director, Don Canham, was trying to build up Michigan's business end and move Strack up into the front office, so to speak. Johnny Orr became head coach, and he really changed the style of Michigan to a run-and-gun team. And it took him those first few years were really tough on him as he made that transition. He had some good players who didn't quite fit. He had one good year when they made the NIT tournament, which back then was a major accomplishment. It's not what it is now. But that team at the end of that particular era, that is 72-73, he had a lot of talent that didn't blend, and that's one of the things you learn when you interview guys and go behind the scenes, like I'm trying to do, about how certain teams with a lot of talent, why don't they succeed? And that was just a team where upperclassmen were not fond of the young guys coming in that take their minutes, and they really didn't blend together and form together as a team, which led to a lot of people calling for Johnny Orr to be fired. One young man, a student at University of Michigan, ran for student government, and his platform was Dump Orr. And he was, as a stunt, he would bring these little cards, these little signs to games to Chrysler Arena, and they'd drop them down, you know, on the team as they were walking out, you know, to the locker room at halftime, you know, Dump Orr. And Johnny Orr, when I talked to him, he told me it was really tough on him. He could hardly show his face in Ann Arbor during those years. But the guy who did that, as you know, later on, wrote him a letter and apologized for that a few years later. So that was kind of interesting.
My guest is Mike Rosenbaum. We're talking about his book, University of Michigan Basketball, 1960-1989. Tell me about Little Skinny Kids, 1973 to 1980. What's that about?
So that's the more successful portion of the Johnny Orr era, when he really got his team together. He figured out how to recruit the guys who would fit his system, that run-and-gun system. And the first team was the opposite of the previous team in that they were expected to finish low in the Big Ten, but this was a team that really gelled together and played as a team. They were the only statistics they were interested in were who had the most assists, because they really wanted to help each other out. And they won an unexpected Big Ten title. They were led by Campy Russell, no relation to Cassie Russell, who was kind of the first really big guard. He's an interesting guy. He was 6'8", played guard, so he's kind of the preceded Magic Johnson in terms of a big guy who could play guard. And he led that team, and he was the star, but he was very team-oriented. And so that kind of set the tone for what that team did and what subsequent teams did. Orr was a guy who would like to get athletes. He was not concerned about certain guys of certain size have to play certain positions. His most successful team had Phil Hubbard at center. He was 6'7", very undersized, especially for the Big Ten going up. Mm-hmm. Going up against guys like Kent Benson. But that team was very successful. He had a 6'3" forward named Wayman Britt, who just ran circles around these power forwards that he played in the Big Ten. The team got to the NCAA final in 1976, the first NCAA final between two teams from the same conference. Michigan did lose that one to Indiana, which was, you know, the powerhouse of the era. Next year's team made the Elite Eight, got upset by North Carolina Charlotte, probably one of the most disappointing upsets Michigan's ever had, because that was a team that was ranked number one and really could have gone all the way, and fell short to Cedric Maxwell's team there at North Carolina Charlotte. But overall, you know, an impressive era there for Johnny Orr, making the NCAA four times. And making two really good runs.
Mike Rosenbaum is our guest, a Detroit area sports writer and editor, and the author of this interesting new book, University of Michigan Basketball, 1960-1989, from Cassie Russell to the NCAA title. We got to take a break. And when we do come back, Mike is going to talk to us about Frieder and the first Fabs, 1980. To 1984. I'm your host, Pat Williams. The show is Inside the Game. The station, AM 950, FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. We'll be right back. Mike Rosenbaum is with us from the Detroit area. We're talking about his book, University of Michigan Basketball. But before we get to that question, Mike, how did the University of Michigan become known as the Wolverines? Do you know the background of that?
Well, Michigan as a state was known as the Wolverine State, and I know that, that this goes back to sometime in the 1800s, actually, the University of Michigan actually precedes the state of Michigan. Michigan, the University of Michigan goes back to 1817. The state of Michigan became in 1837, but somewhere along there, Michigan became known as the Wolverine State, and there's really debate about how that happened and whether there really were many actual Wolverines in the state of Michigan, or whether that was just referred to because Wolverine hides were traded in Michigan. But there's been, I know now, I don't think there's many sightings of Wolverines in Michigan other than a couple of them that are at the Detroit Zoo.
Interesting.
But Michigan did have, Michigan's one of the schools that doesn't have mascots, doesn't have people in costumes, and that's because in the 1920s, they decided that the team's mascots would be two live Wolverines that they had in a cage named Biff and Benny. And unfortunately, the Wolverines are very tough creatures, and the people handling them got bitten a couple of times. They decided that maybe having live mascots wasn't such a good idea. So the Wolverines got sent to the Detroit Zoo, so they got a nice home. And so the tradition out in Michigan is you don't have mascots unless they're live mascots.
Mike, tell us about Frieder and the first Fabs.
Well, Bill Frieder is one of the most interesting guys I talked to. In fact, I talked to him for about, I think I did five interviews with him for about 3 hours. He's a fascinating character. He was a student at Michigan in the 60s. He watched Cassie Russell play. He was in the business school. He was going to go into business. He had offers after school to go in really well-paying jobs. But he had been so fascinated by basketball during the Cassie Russell era that he decided he'd go to become a high school teacher so he could be a basketball coach. He had never been he had played basketball, but not, at college, not really, really good. He became an assistant coach at Michigan when a job opens, and he sold himself to Johnny Orr. He literally followed Johnny Orr around to several promotional stops Orr was making to get him to hire Frieder as an assistant coach. And then he became a relentless recruiter, and then Orr's number one assistant. And then when Johnny Orr left for Iowa State, Bill Frieder became the head coach and really took Michigan recruiting up a notch, even from where Orr was. And he just was famous for putting huge numbers of miles in his car, and for doing amazing things in recruiting. Like, Terry Mills told me that he was just in school during a period when coaches were not allowed to contact recruits directly, but he would walk down the hall and suddenly he'd see Bill Frieder just walking ahead of him in his line of sight and then walking away. It was like, just to let him know that, Mills was wanted. And that's the kind of guy Frieder was. He was a relentless worker. And the years 1980 through 84 was kind of building up Michigan again, rebuilding through the recruiting process, including a class of five recruits that he brought in that were called the Fab Five.
Mm-hmm.
But they did not immediately have the success that the later Fab Five had, so the nickname kind of faded away pretty quickly. But that's why the chapter is called the First Fabs, because there was a class that actually was the Fab Five, the best player being actually the least heralded player of that group, Roy Tarpley, who was a guy Frieder saw play in the summer. He had never been a high school star, but Frieder says this guy, he's growing and he's getting better and he's on the way up. So that was Frieder's knack for finding talent. Tarpley at Michigan eventually became Big Ten Player of the Year, so, and was a foundational piece of those teams that ended up winning the NIT championship in 84. And that was kind of it was a bigger deal than the NIT is now, and that kind of paved the way for more success in the coming years.
Mike, tell us about building toward the summit, 1984 to 88.
So that's the years that Michigan is kind of gradually on the rise. You know, back in those days, players didn't leave early very often. Maybe after a junior year, they might leave. So you had players longer, so you could build things up. He had, as I said, Roy Tarpley. He had Gary Grant, a great point guard, came in from Ohio. 4-year starter, and he was immensely important. Grant was a real character. He would talk to the team before games. He was a team captain, and he would be really serious, and then he'd start joking around, and apparently does a really good Bill Frieder imitation. So, and then another key guy they got, and it's interesting the way recruiting works, is Glenn Rice. Glenn Rice was on nobody's radar in terms of a major teams. He was actually considering committing to Central Michigan in the MAC conference, mainly because he was played on such loaded high school teams in Flint, Michigan that he didn't get a chance to play too much. And he was not on anybody's radar, even Frieder. Frieder had three guys he was focusing on in the Midwest who all decided to go to other Big Ten schools. So Glenn Rice was not plan A, plan B, or plan C. He was kind of became plan D when Frieder struck out on those other guys. And then he started to pursue Glenn Rice, and then Rice took off as a high school senior and became Michigan's the state player of the year. And he showed what he could do, and then other teams got in. But Michigan had been there first, and Glenn Rice signed with Michigan. But if Frieder had signed one of those or a couple of those other guys, Rice may have gone elsewhere. So it's funny the way things work out. And Rice was one of those real team players who actually early in his career had to play power forward just because of the way the roster was structured. So he, instead of being an outside shooter, as he became, he was the team's leading rebounder because he was willing to do the kind of the dirty work when he had to. Gary Grant was another guy like that. The team was loaded with forwards when he came in, so he became a pass-first point guard. And then as the team shifted to a more balanced lineup in his later years, he blossomed as a scorer, a 20-point-a-game scorer. So Frieder was recruiting guys not only of not only excellent players but good character too, and that's part of what led the group as they rose. The only disappointing part of that particular era was that Michigan did not play particularly well in the NCAA tournament. Several of those years, the 2 years they won the Big Ten back to back, they got bounced in the second round of the tournament, almost became the first number one seed. To lose to a 16 seed, barely scraped by in one of those games. So that was the only disappointment. And then the last year in that era, 88, Michigan did better, won two NCAA tournament games, and then lost to a powerhouse North Carolina team, which was the second year in a row that North Carolina had bounced Michigan from the tournament. But still, that last year of that particular period, they were on the rise.
Mike, at the end of your book, you talk about the mission, 1988 to 89, and then redemption and reward in 1989. Tell us about that period. We got about 3 minutes left.
Okay, so that's the year Michigan got to the summit, got to the NCAA championship. And of course, people remember how Bill Frieder, during the season, accepted another job for the next season for Arizona State, and he was going to be a lame duck. And Bo Schembechler famously said, only a Michigan man will coach Michigan. And so Steve Fisher became Michigan's coach for the NCAA tournament. Michigan had a good but not great season. They finished third in the Big Ten and a really strong Big Ten, so that's a good season. Michigan was still a top 10 team. And was playing better as the season went on. Toward the end of the season, they had a real run after losing the game to Indiana by a point. Glenn Rice in a locker room speech afterwards said, "We're going on a mission to shock the world." And so the NCAA tournament comes up, and their mission starts with a brand new coach, Steve Fisher, who had never been a head coach in college before. And, of course, they ran all the way to the NCAA title, won the game in overtime on Rumeal Robinson's two free throws. And they always, the big question is, would they have done that with Bill Frieder as head coach? And there's just no way to ever know, because the team played the same style as Frieder. The team was on the rise toward the end of the season. It's conceivable they could have done it with Frieder. The one thing they kind of gained without Frieder, you know, because of the coaching change, was kind of an us against the world mentality because people thought, well, they've got this new head coach. The team's shaken up. They'll never go anywhere. They'll never do it. So that kind of motivation added to the mix. And they ended up going all the way. Glenn Rice set a record. I think that still stands for most points in an NCAA tournament. And interestingly, he hit all the big shots until the final game. The final second of regulation, he missed a shot that would have won it for Michigan and sent it in overtime. And he told me afterwards, you know what, I had it lined up. I thought I was going to hit it. And that's probably why I missed. because I was so sure I was going to make the shot, I let up a little bit. But Michigan, of course, did pull it out in overtime. Steve Fisher gave an interesting speech right before the overtime period. He told his team that a psychic had told him Michigan was going to win the game in overtime. And Mark Hughes, a forward on the team, was going to be part of the winning play. And what happened at the end is that Real Robinson drives to the basket in the final seconds and passes off to Hughes, but a foul was called on Robinson, on Seton Hall, and Robinson went to the line and hit the two free throws. And I asked Mark Hughes, well, if they hadn't called the foul, what would have happened? And Mark says, you know, right on cue, says, that would have been me on the cover of Sports Illustrated. I would have won the game for it.
Mike Rosenbaum has written a marvelous book. We're so pleased we can chat with him. University of Michigan Basketball, 1960 to 1989. Go get it. Thanks for joining us here on Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams. We do this every weekend, get to talk sports with some really interesting people. You're plugged into AM 950, FM 94.9, The Answer. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll see you next weekend. Good sports.
Inside the Game with Pat Williams is a pre-recorded show.